ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The Internet of Things sounded okay at first, until I heard about that e-fridge automatically updating your dwindling stocks without asking, ordering milk and fish fingers you don't need. Fascist fridges were bad enough, but now it's wired clothes, computerized knickers. How do you possibly get dressed in the future? Hello, Robin Williams with a Connected Science Show featuring that e-clothing later in this program. First, I want you to meet Professor Paul Wenberg. Paul, what do you do?
So my research group builds instruments that fly on airplanes to measure atmospheric composition, and we're currently involved in a big NASA campaign to study air quality over a number of cities in Southeast Asia.
Why would NASA be interested in that?
NASA has been building sensors for space, of course. That's its primary activity. And as part of that, the South Koreans got out ahead of the rest of the world in building a spacecraft that could monitor air quality in exquisite detail in what's called geostationary orbit, meaning it sits over Southeast Asia. NASA just launched its own such sensor. And so this activity that has begun over many years ago now is to try to understand how to integrate observations that you make from the ground, from airplanes, and from space to understand air quality and how to improve air quality over cities.
Paul Wenberg is at Caltech, a campus where what seems simple turns out to be deeply, even wonderfully sophisticated. That straightforward measurement of air quality is basic to planning a real attempt to solve the global climate challenge.
We certainly find that until you go out and measure things, it's very difficult to make predictions about either what's happened in the past or what's happening in the future. And I think climate science is one of those key fields where observationally driven science has been really critical for understanding the fate of Earth. And towards that, the other major activity in my research group has been observations of greenhouse gases in Earth's atmosphere. So I've been involved in a number of missions to study composition of greenhouse gases over the world using remote sensing from space and from the ground.
Where I was last year, San Diego, I talked to Ralph Keeling, who is the son of Dave, who produced the Keeling Curve, which was doing something which seemed to be just pure science, but it turns out to be absolutely crucial. And I think you know the Keelings.
Yeah, so David Keeling, the father now, invented the measurement of CO2 in the atmosphere. You could measure with sufficient precision to observe changes in CO2. And he did it to try to understand the interaction of atmospheric carbon dioxide with fresh waters. It was really a rather minimalist idea about why one would do this. But quickly, his vision expanded to understanding global climate change. And so beginning in the geophysical year, Keeling established a network of observations that today we now call the Keeling Curve, which observe the increasing abundance of CO2 in the air. What's interesting is that the CO2 that's been increasing comes from burning of fossil fuels. So when the fossil fuels are burned, you consume oxygen because you convert, say, a carbon-carbon bond into two CO2 molecules. And so the son, Ralph Keeling, who I was working with when I was a student at Harvard, invented the first machine to measure the oxygen going down as a result of the combustion of CO2. The cool thing about this is that while a lot of the carbon dioxide that is going into the atmosphere ends up going into the ocean eventually, the oxygen doesn't, because oxygen is just sparingly soluble in ocean water. And so you can observe by the fact that the oxygen is going down faster than the CO2 is going up, you can observe how much of the fossil fuels that we emit end up going into the ocean. We don't have to worry about running out of oxygen to breathe, but through this exquisite observation of how much oxygen is in the air, you can actually see what we are doing to the atmosphere.
And how are you applying these measurements?
We've been working on two different aspects. First of all, is just how does climate interact with the biosphere? So I mentioned the CO2 goes into the ocean. It also goes into the plants and to the soil. And currently, about half of the CO2 that we emit into the atmosphere ends up going into either the ocean or the biosphere. And what we're trying to understand then is how are the forests and the trees evolving as the climate changes? Will this service that they're doing, taking up a lot of CO2, continue into the future? So we've been studying in particular the northern forests, and this is a large swath of forests that extend across between 45 degrees north latitude and 70 latitude. These forests do not exist in the southern hemisphere because that's the southern ocean.
And of course, you've got up, including Canada, vast forests, but they're not really lapping up the CO2 and flourishing because there are other effects of climate change, including the pests, the worms, and God knows what else.
Yeah, the last big aircraft campaign we did to study atmospheric composition was to look at the fires of the western North America. And it is actually true. Large swaths of Canada burned this last summer as a result of both very dry conditions and the degraded forest.
And also, to some extent, even though CO2 is something that plants use, you've got to have nutritional aspects in the soil. Otherwise, they don't grow because you don't just have one element.
Yeah, it's exactly true. Nitrogen, phosphate, there's a number of other ingredients that make up biomass. But a critical aspect of the northern ecology is that the climate is changing incredibly fast. So while there's been significant global warming, this year is about 1.5 degrees warmer, say, than pre-industrial, the warming is amplified over land and amplified even further over the northern land. And as a result of that, these forests are experiencing a very, very rapid change in the climate. And that's leaving behind a lot of the trees. In other words, if you look at where needleleaf trees grow, they tend to grow in colder places. And so a lot of these forests are composed of needleleaf trees. But as the climate is warming, those trees are becoming less and less able to survive and, in fact, lead to these large conflagration that we've observed over the last few years.
So being a professor in this place, Caltech, for you involves about 10 fields of different aspects of science.
It's a wonderful thing about Caltech. We're a very small institution, as you know. What that means is that you just talk to lots of different people who don't do exactly what you do, but you realize that you have things that you could do together and problems that you didn't even know existed that can be solved through these interactions with, say, data scientists or chemists or others. So it's a wonderful place to be a scientist.
You just cross the campus and there is the world expert on this as well. But going back to the atmosphere and the rubbish you often get, especially around Southeast Asia, where some countries, without naming them, you can barely breathe. How much is that, the particles in the atmosphere, the rubbish up there, affecting their own local climate?
So it's a very interesting and complicated answer. Particles in the air, on average, tend to actually cool the surface below them. That is to say, they reflect away enough sunlight that they can make the surface cooler than it would be without the particles. And this is actually one of the biggest challenges in understanding the past climate change, is the role of these small particles. How much have they offset the warming that comes from the increasing greenhouse gases? Because it's very clear that aerosol pollution is going down. It's hard to believe it, but over Southeast Asia and over China in particular, the amount of particles in the air has been going down very, very quickly as they install the same kinds of technologies that you would find in Australia and the United States and Europe that minimize the pollution coming from, say, automobiles. And so as a result, as the air over the cities becomes cleaner, it results in amplified warming. And so this idea that there's always co-benefits, that if we somehow clean up the industry, we're going to also help the climate, doesn't always play out that way.
Okay, finally, a $64,000 question. If you get to a point, which seems to be getting closer and closer, where you think the climate's getting out of control, we have to do something drastic, geoengineering. So instead of waiting for the volcano to give us a blanket instead of the pollution, we put up stuff there, sulfates, who knows, imitating volcanic explosions. Would you be for or against that if the crunch comes?
So I've been involved in a lot of discussions around just this question. And I was involved in a big National Academy of Sciences report that came out just a few years ago. And the consensus of that report, and it reflects my own view, is that these are technologies that we really need to study to understand the potential for harm reduction and also the potential risks associated with these. You get into all sorts of questions around diplomacy, who gets to control the knob. It's just an incredibly difficult question. But there's no doubt in my mind that we need to consider and understand these technologies because they may offer a temporary avenue for harm reduction, particularly in areas of the world right now that are suffering the largest impacts from climate change, but also have little resources to mitigate those and adapt to those changes.
Yeah, the problem is some of the experiments were being on very, very small scale were blocked because people said it's too much of a risk.
Yeah, it is definitely controversial. But I think this is why a unified research program from many, many nations is really essential, because otherwise we will run in just exactly to what you mentioned, that it's very difficult to do experiments. And so there's also a lot that can be done without actually doing experiments. We know a lot about the potential of these technologies through volcanoes that you mentioned. And so there's lots that can be done to study how these technologies might work absent a large-scale deployment.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, Robin.
Professor Paul Wenberg is an atmospheric scientist at Caltech in Pasadena. And Reese Halter is a concerned forest watcher from his vantage in Northern California. His latest observations are a worry.
All-time record sea surface global temperatures are playing hell with Earth's native forest, and especially the Amazon rainforest, which at this time of year should be drenched with monsoonal rains. Instead, a brutal drought has kept the rains at bay, creating tinderbox dry conditions that have burned many hundreds of square kilometers of the rainforest that do not usually burn. A record number of fires have plagued the Amazon so far this year. In January alone, the Brazilian Amazon lost 11,000 square kilometers. That's a fourfold increase from the same time last year. Is this a precursor to June's onset of the official dry season in the southern Amazon? Raging climate firestorms across 9 South American countries are the result of an extreme drought fueled by global heating. Compounding matters even more, an angry El Niño has ratcheted the temperatures, duration, and frequencies of heat waves many notches higher, worsening South America's continental mega drought. Fast-spreading blazes are tearing into the parched Amazon rainforest. Untold numbers of animals, the heartbeat of the rainforest, have burned alive. Early estimates say at least another billion creatures are gone. Meanwhile, 7,000 kilometers to the north, 150 wildfires, known as zombies, burned all winter long under skinny snowpacks in British Columbia and Alberta. It's bone meal dry across Western Canada, and the fire season in Alberta, which usually begins in March, was declared in February. Last year, Canadian wildfires scorched an astounding 18.5 million hectares. The dice are loaded in 2024 for what could be another hellacious bushfire season for both British Columbia and Alberta. Those zombie fires are immediate ignition sources, so when the winds and temperature kick up, bushfires take off. Further to the south, Texas spring wildfires charred the largest area in state history and became the second largest wildfire in U.S. history. The Smoke Creek fire alone has raised 450,000 hectares. Western United States, too, is parched and amid a deepening mega drought. Fire ecologist Professor Emeritus Stephen Pine told me this. Unwittingly, humans have created a fire age, but whether they can inhabit that world is unclear. It's a future that seems so dire, and its likely trajectory so strange that some observers argue that the past has become irrelevant. We are, they fear, headed into a no-narrative, no-analog tomorrow. So immense and unimaginable are the coming upheavals that the arc of inherited knowledge that joins the past to the future is broken. There's no precedent for what we are set to experience, no means by which to triangulate from accumulated wisdom into a future unlike anything we have known before. For Radio National's The Science Show, I am Rhys Halter.
Yes, Rhys doesn't pull his punches on fire, and with such mounting news, why would you? So that's why solutions are vital, and chemist Distinguished Professor Sarah Talbot, for 25 years at UCLA, has joined the U.S. Department of Energy on its Earthshot program.
So this is a new program within the Department of Energy that is aiming to solve hard problems at home using the idea of the moonshot. So when the U.S. first put a person on the moon, it was an effort of many different agencies working together to solve a whole lot of technological problems. And the idea is to now take that team kind of effort and try to solve technological problems related to energy here at home.
And you're working on batteries?
We are working on batteries. Can you make energy storage cheap enough that you can store the energy from renewable sources, wind, solar, for their number is 10 hours, so that you can build infrastructure into your grid or your city that has the capacity to store renewable energy basically all night until the sun comes out again and you have your original renewable source back. And really what that translates to is making energy storage cheaper, because we could build as many batteries as we wanted right now, but the cost is just prohibitive.
So Elon Musk's batteries are very costly.
Elon Musk's batteries cost the same as a Tesla, which is probably all I should say.
Very discreet. And what line are you taking? Is it the structure of the batteries or the ingredients or what?
So what we are focusing on is trying to move away from lithium-ion batteries to something called sodium-ion batteries. So the idea here is, in a lithium-ion battery, which is the battery in your laptop, in your phone, in your electric vehicle, you have two parts of your battery, an anode and a cathode, and lithium ions shuttle back and forth between them. And the battery charges when you move the lithium from one side, from the cathode to the anode, and it discharges when it moves back. And the reason everybody uses lithium is because lithium is very, very little. It is, in fact, the smallest stable ion that we have on the periodic table. The hydrogen ion is smaller, but it's so small that it's sort of a lonely ion, and it tends to almost always react with something and not be a free ion. But lithium is a stable ion, and it's the smallest one we have. And so it most easily shuttles back and forth and makes batteries that can charge many, many times.
You said it's stable, but doesn't it burst into flames now and then?
That's lithium metal. So that's lithium with its extra electron. It really doesn't want that extra electron, and it gives it up very easily to make lithium plus, which is the lithium ion that is actually moving back and forth in your lithium-ion battery.
Now, if you're going for an alternative, in other words, sodium's so abundant, surely. Hasn't it been done before?
It has, but it doesn't work well. So certainly people have said on the periodic table, what's right below lithium? it's sodium. Surely sodium should work almost as well as lithium. But the problem is it's a lot bigger. And so when it tries to move back and forth from the anode to the cathode, sometimes it gets stuck and it just doesn't move. And then your battery loses capacity. And sometimes it moves very, very slowly. And you can only discharge your battery very slowly. Charging slowly is not so good if you're traveling across the country and you run out of battery in your car and you'd like to recharge it quickly. And discharging slowly is also not so good if you would like to push on the gas pedal and have your car move rapidly. So the speed is an issue on both charging and discharging. But the bigger issue is it gets stuck in the lattice. And so batteries made with sodium don't live very long.
Just a reminder, talking about the periodic table, which I'm sure all our listeners are very familiar with, we're talking about lithium and sodium, which are top left, not in the same line, one below the other, as you said. But what are you doing yourself in your research to try to solve this problem?
So we have a new center, which is called STOR, because it is about energy storage. STOR stands for Strain Optimization for Renewable Energy. And what we're trying to do is come up with ways to make materials that can hold the sodium and not let it get stuck and not make it move slowly. And so we have a bunch of ways that we're working on doing this. One is to make hosts for the sodium that have cavities that are big enough for the sodium to move around in, that are also extremely rigid, so that as the sodium moves in and out, they can't rearrange. One of the problems is that when you stick an ion in a material, the whole material sort of collapses around that ion, and that can trap it in place.
Interesting. But lithium, of course, is expensive to some extent compared to sodium, even though one of the great sources of lithium is Australia. And we'd hate to have you stop buying our lithium, of course. But what way are you actually doing it now? Is it reaching a zenith of the announcements next week or next month or what?
Oh, the quest for good sodium ion batteries is a long-term quest. So first off, you do not need to worry about lack of interest in lithium. Lithium will remain the highest performance battery material. And for the best batteries, I think they will, at least for the foreseeable future, remain lithium ion based. But currently, we are trying to expand the use of renewable energy all around the globe so that we can burn less fossil fuels and we can create less carbon dioxide emission. But all renewable energy sources are intermittent. Wind power generates electricity when the wind blows and does not generate electricity when the wind doesn't blow. Solar energy generates electricity when the sun is out and the clouds are not there, and it doesn't work at night and it doesn't work when it's cloudy. And the problem is the electric grid does not work on that scale. The electric grid needs to supply power to people when they need it. The biggest need is often in the evening when everyone comes home from work and wants to run their laundry and charge their car and turn on their lights. And that is usually a time when neither wind nor solar are being particularly productive. So if we want to up the fraction of the grid that is renewable energy, we have to have more energy storage. And so I think the time is now to really think about this, because people are contemplating just how many lithium-ion batteries you would need to put as much renewable energy on the grid as we would like, and they are seeing that the numbers don't match.
And the numbers don't match even for the alternative ones, because I'm thinking of the gel-ion batteries. In other words, we've got gel instead of the liquid. I'm thinking of also printing a sort of organic solar, which is happening at the University of Newcastle, where they've got semiconductors that you can print out almost like wallpaper. You know, if you add all these different alternatives together, won't they make, to some extent, batteries just another ingredient beside the point?
Well, actually, things like printable solar are exactly why you need batteries. Because the more easily deployable solar you have, the more you need to be able to store that energy for the times when the sun doesn't shine. So I will give you an example. I live here in Los Angeles. It is almost always beautifully sunny, blue sky, beaches, palm trees. It actually is sort of what the pictures tell you of Los Angeles. So we have a lot of sun, and we have a lot of people who would like to contribute to helping reduce global warming. And we have a lot of solar in Los Angeles. We have a lot of rooftop solar. And we are at the point that in the middle of the afternoon, when the sun is shining its brightest and nobody is using electricity because they're all away doing other things, we have too much electricity. We can't use all the solar that is generated in the bright of the afternoon. But it's 6 or 7 o'clock at night when everyone is home from work. We definitely need more electricity. So even now, we are at the point where we need energy storage to balance the amount of renewable energy. And the goal is to massively expand the amount of renewable energy that we put onto the grid.
I wish you luck. It's very, very exciting stuff, is it not?
It's very exciting to both be part of what we hope is a revolution in renewable energy, but also to be part of developing new ideas for new technologies. From a chemist point of view, batteries are a beautiful system because they involve all of the basic chemistry. They involve ions moving and reactions, but they also are a practical thing that can have a positive impact. So they're a very fun system to work on.
Especially when the innovation succeeds. Just imagine, distinguished Professor Sarah Talbot at University of California, Los Angeles. The Science Show on RN, where last week we mentioned the Science Gallery at Melbourne University, where they've just been to the dark side with a display of imaginative ideas about the missing 85% of the universe. People flocked there. So now Ryan Jeffries, who runs the gallery, is looking to what's next. Dark was based on physics, but Ryan, you're more biomedical, aren't you? Do you deal happily with new physical frontiers?
Absolutely. I love new knowledge. It's certainly outside of my area of expertise, but when it is things at this scale, it just is so fascinating. We had a work by an artist, a local artist, John Butt, which was a muon detector. He created his own muon detector as an artist during the pandemic, just based on stuff that he saw online. And then all of the physicists who've come in were just blown away. They were incredibly inspired that an artist could create a meaningful piece of scientific equipment, which was also an artwork.
A reminder about what Science Gallery is all about, because it began in Trinity College Dublin, where you take an idea and you build something around it that people can go to. And this, of course, specializes to some extent with the University of Melbourne's material. And is that more or less a summary of what you've got? It's not a straight kind of exhibition as you get in a museum, but it's a big ideas and experience thing.
Absolutely right. Science Gallery is just this very non-traditional space. We're there to shake things up a little bit, to not be your traditional art gallery or science museum. And people are taken aback a little bit about that. So it's more an experimental space. It's welcoming, but it is a testing ground of ideas and collaboration. Some of the works are very DIY. It's not this polished artwork kind of outcome. And many of the works are very hands-on. So it's the opportunity for the audience to become part of the work itself. We also highlight active research happening at the University of Melbourne or other institutions in the gallery floor. And I think that's a really unique point of Science Gallery that separates it from some of the other traditional institutions.
And the public then knows more or less what it's going to, does it? Or do they just wander in and stay because it's intriguing?
I think it's a mixture of both. We're still very much building an audience, and that's important. We've been open for 2 years now. We've had over 200,000 people through. But we love that element of surprise. We want that in terms of not knowing exactly what to expect as you walk through the doors of Science Gallery.
And it does actually relate very well to the true nature of science, because if you look at, obviously, nanotechnology, if you look at aspects of Einstein's ideas, relativity and so on, you're into all sorts of areas, rather like Alice in Wonderland. Does this help young people who have got to do homework, have got to keep to the curriculum, or do they find it distracting and confusing sometimes?
I think it certainly helps, and that really is a core mission of Science Gallery as well. A huge part of our audience is actually through schools and tertiary students. So our fastest growing audience is high school students, and I think we're at this point of almost crisis in terms of where we're at with the current state of learning, of pedagogy. I think it's no surprise to many people that we need to change how we are teaching young people and for them to have really interesting opportunities to kind of learn. So Science Gallery of Melbourne includes the STEM Centre of Excellence. It's supported by the state government of Victoria. And we then tap into the school's curriculum through the work that we're doing through our exhibitions and programs. It really is helping students with their learning in a really non-traditional way. And we're seeing some really exciting outcomes from that. It really is more about interdisciplinarity. It's also about very hands-on skills-based learning. So breaking down those silos of perhaps traditional discipline boundaries.
As you say, there is a crisis and lack of teachers and so on, the teachers overstretched. How can they deal with extracurricular stuff as well as all the other paperwork and so on and so on? And the next exhibition is Not Natural. It seems to me you've already been not natural, perhaps.
In many ways, yes. So we're always wanting to kind of push those boundaries. So our current exhibition is Not Natural, and it's really exploring that tension between biological and artificial systems. So we're seeing the rise of genetic engineering and also AI and what happens when they both collide together. So essentially, I think we're opening this Pandora's box of possibility. We have these really unique tools now where we can gene edit, we can de-extinct, but it also raises a whole lot of ethical dilemmas. Because should we? Are we then playing God? And so that's what this exhibition is about. It really looks at future possibilities and asks that question, is this the future that we want?
While the exhibition is on, are you going to bring the Tasmanian tiger back to life?
It is in the exhibition and really draws upon some research at the University of Melbourne. There is a huge investment around this idea of de-extinction, and bringing back the Tasmanian tiger, the thylacine, is top of the list. And it's quite probable within 5 to 10 years, we may have the Tasmanian tiger back. So within the exhibition, we really profile that research. We look at community responses in terms of the diversity of ideas of should we? And interestingly, there has been a few surveys that suggest a majority of people do want the Tasmanian tiger back. But it's still a question in my mind as we face potentially global mass extinction event. Should we be focusing on certain species and really investing in bringing them back when we're at risk of losing so many others?
With all those challenging ideas and concepts that you are putting in front of people, have you had any opposition in the last couple of years?
The general response to Science Gallery has been really positive. It sometimes takes a little while for people to get it in terms of what we're about, but I think that's important. You go on that journey and then you understand the benefit of new knowledge systems, new ways of developing interdisciplinary collaboration, and the importance of creativity and collaboration together.
Good luck. I can't wait to see it.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Ryan Jeffries is director of Science Gallery Melbourne. It's on the Melbourne University campus. And before we leave Melbourne and leap back to Pasadena, do meet Dr. Sundance Jehong Sun, who led the team in the United Nations Dartathon, as it was dubbed last month. With their topic, in which regions across the globe would solar farms be most efficient? And where is that energy most needed? Sundance, as she's known to her friends, incidentally did her PhD on critical thinking, They won two prizes, in fact, both for being a congenial and welcoming team and for their data ideas.
So we've got two awards, one for the second place around the world, and the other one is the best team at the Oceania region. Yeah.
Oceania, yes. Second place in the world, that's pretty fantastic.
I'm still pinching myself about it, to be honest, but it has been incredibly meaningful for us. Yes, the second place, competing with over 400 teams from over 100 countries around the world.
Tell me what you actually put in there as what turned out to be a second prize winning global event.
I think the key experience for me is the teamwork, or be passionate about the issue that you really want to address. So when I'm looking back, there are certain moments, but nothing is like the cutthroat competition. So I'll give you an example. In our workspace at the University of Queensland Technology, with the beautiful botanical garden view outside our window.
It is lovely.
It is. It's a beautiful campus. And also we really enjoyed working together with the calming nature video we projected on the bigger screen in the room as a background. And also we had lots of lollipops on our table throughout the whole time. It was also really enjoyable for members from other teams drop by our room and we had a nice chat about each other's projects. So nothing really as you would expect, like a competitive competition.
So what you're saying really is the essence of what keeps science in social science together, and that is the talent of collaboration. In other words, making the atmosphere work so that human beings can interact.
Can't agree more. Definitely.
So you were sharing data in general, or was it on a particular line of thought?
The UN data then asked us to come up with our solution that's relevant to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, the transition to clean and affordable energy.
What would you do?
I would continue to work on, understand better about which part of the world where the solar farms can be most efficient, and also which part of the world would stand to benefit the most, and then identify the most efficient place to build solar farms and to get the most benefit.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your PhD, because critical thinking is the essence of what we can do to resist the fake news problem. In other words, the lies that are pushed by trolls and such like, as a political weapon almost, but also a nuisance. Now, how do you actually help people become critical thinkers, especially at schools?
That's a very complex question. But I can tell you that for my PhD study, I pointed out the issue first. And I argued that our education system is not quite there yet to develop what we value about critical thinkers. Instead, it tends to value what we assess about critical thinking.
How to value it?
How to value it is really about what do you think critical thinkers should be in the contemporary world. It's more about your expectations. Like what you just said, you hope critical thinkers should have the capability of telling what is true and what is false, what to believe. So based on my study, I actually defined critical thinking and introduced epistemic beliefs as part of the critical thinking construct, which means the attitudes to knowledge and knowing. And my argument is that I think epistemic beliefs is the gap in the current education system, but it's so crucial, especially in this information age. It actually acts as a filter of information, or it actually enables individuals to filter what's right and what's true, distinguishing the true information from the myths or false or alternative truths.
Mm-hmm. Epistemology, as they call it.
Epistemology is the study about knowledge, but epistemic beliefs is really you don't need to know, but you do need to develop a sophisticated set of belief system in this contemporary world to sort of act as a compass to help you navigate through the information.
Well, congratulations and thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Sundance Jihong Sun from the University of Melbourne, whose team won second place globally for their work on where to put those solar farms to serve communities everywhere. That was at the UN Datathon, where they also got the prize for friendly engagement. This is a science show on RN, where we now turn, as promised, to those fascist fridges and other online gadgetry, knowing better than you do how to organise your life. Imagine all your machines deciding to install 15 updates, each on the same day. But Professor Chiara Darayo thinks it'll be smoother and nicer than I've described, not least with your wired clothing. Chiara, if I may call you that, I'd like to do a thought experiment. It's 10 years' time, and I'm getting up and I'm getting dressed, and the technology I'm using now, some of the complex material I've just put on your desk with wires and all sorts of dials and things like that, that won't be there. It'll be built into my clothing somehow. How will I get dressed? In the normal way?
I think we're heading towards a wearable revolution. We're going to be dressing the same way, but the clothing and the accessories we will be putting on will be rather different. They'll be smarter. They'll be seamlessly integrated with technology, with electronics that will be embedded in every fibers of our clothing. It will be able to sense our well-being and potentially even predict how our day will turn out.
So the information will be flowing the minute we get dressed. But then someone like me, I buy new clothes once every 10 years. I mean, when you go to a shop to buy clothes, will you give a computer address so that they can then wire your clothes before you leave the shop?
I think at the beginning, it's probably going to be more about accessories. Think about the ones you're already wearing now. And we can think about smartwatches that are already in our everyday life. You can think about smart glasses, which in some cases are already commercially available. But now you can start thinking about smart earrings, perhaps smart necklaces or belts or other accessories that we don't need to necessarily purchase every year all the time. And those will embed computing power, sensing powers, and just in general communication devices that are similar to the ones that are embedded today in our cell phones, smartphones, but will go beyond in that they'll be able to seamlessly integrate information from our, for example, physical well-being, metabolic activities, perhaps sleep, but also motion patterns. And maybe emotional.
And emotional as well. Well, that's extraordinary. But the kinds of things that I'm thinking of are in some ways more practical, in that sometimes the technologies which are operating separately will raise an alarm. You know, imagine you go to an intelligent toilet, and they've had them in Japan for many, many years, except you've got one at home and it measures your fluids as you perform. And it's concerned about the fact that there's a bit too much of a particular salt. Does it get in touch straight with your medical service and suddenly the alarms go or what?
Wow, that remains to be seen. I think there's potential for people, for example, with chronic diseases to communicate directly with maybe healthcare providers, nurses. To a certain extent, the technology we wear today, like our cell phone can predict or smartwatches can predict falls. And in fact, I did fall and my watch asked me how I was doing or whether I was in need of calling 911. And I think that's technology today. In the future, perhaps think about people with chronic diseases like diabetes or people that are perhaps confined to care at home. I think technologies that will instrument our home as well as our clothing will perhaps provide more freedom, more regular life activities in situations where right now a lot of us
You said seamlessly, you said, you know, more comfortably. Now, we spend our lives trying to remember passwords. And if you don't remember the passwords, you can't do all sorts of things. And if you try to find them out, you're almost under arrest if you're, you know, the mechanism is blocked. Will the various systems that want to know who you are know automatically from your clothing and from your body who you are without going through all that nonsense?
I think that's something that, again, it's a technology that we already have to a certain extent. Think about fingerprint recognition or eye recognition, eye scanning, which I use now to get on a plane, right, without the need for showing ID cards anymore. Those will be probably more and more integrated into clothing and accessories we use. For example, your glasses may be able to recognize who you are from scanning your eye. And the same will go, for example, from touch and fingerprinting. And there is other fingerprints our body has, other biomarkers, if you want, that really uniquely identify who you are. And more these will be integrated with technologies we can wear every day.
And what's your role in this wonderful revolution? Are you concentrating on the materials?
Yeah, my research since the very beginning has been focusing on discovering new materials and materials that span the chemistry of materials. For example, we develop new polymers that use ions instead of electrons to communicate with electronic devices, but also materials that embed other functionalities, for example, being stretchable and foldable or changing stiffness on command. And all of these materials will be, I hope, embedded in the future of wearable technologies to make smarter and more comfortable wearables in the future.
How do you change stiffness on command? Do you tell your trousers to become rather more smart, or I don't know?
Yes, actually. Some of the materials we developed exploit geometry of the constitutive elements in order to lock. Think about puzzle pieces. Now you have a fabric that is soft and drapeable, but all of a sudden, on command, for example, when you feel tired or when you need to lift something heavy, can be switched on to interlocking ever more and going from flexible and foldable to being rigid, like a continuous piece of material. This is something in the lab you can see today. Then, of course, the challenges with wearables is that you need to make them not just into a fabric swap that you can just show in the lab, but into something that's manufacturable to scale in large quantities. And we're not quite there yet.
How much is this personal? Because I can imagine naughty people, and I can sometimes be naughty. If I know a code to say a magic word, I could then tell your clothing to do something before you know what's happening.
Oh, hacking clothing. This is an interesting possibility. It's certainly one of these many questions that can be raised when you think about the ethics of smart clothing and the safety, the personal security, the privacy. Those are, I think, all very good questions that we need to grapple with once the technology is more mature before we send it out into commercial spaces.
How is your work on the materials going? Are you able to find possibilities spreading before you with all sorts of good possibilities, or is it all very, very tricky and complicated and difficult for you? In other words, you might be okay yourself, but when you imagine the world of manufacturing and ordinary people handling this, will it be beyond them, do you think?
I think humankind has been adapting to ever-growing and fast-paced technology. So I am, in that sense, an optimist in that I believe that everybody will be able to adapt. Look at just the smartphone and technology revolutions. My kids were so apt at using these systems much quicker than I ever was 30 years before them. And I think that will continue. I think the question will be, how do we regulate this space? How do we make sure that financial interests don't surpass the societal interests? Those are really good questions that I feel like maybe as a society we should be thinking about. But of course, in the case of what my lab is doing, we're really just mostly focusing about the fundamental scientific questions that are underpinning discovery of new materials for smarter wearables. So we're a bit removed from that.
You're a bit removed, actually, here at Caltech, from many university campuses and manufacturing areas around the world. But are they doing similar sorts of work in your home country of Italy?
There are, of course, I think, centers of excellence everywhere. And Italy certainly has a phenomenal collection of talent that is distributed in the various universities, some of which, you know, unfortunately, you see abroad, but in other cases, is still present there. And in fact, we do collaborate, for example, with the Italian Institute of Technology, with colleagues in Milan, in Turin, and often exchange students.
Oh, that's fashion stuff, collaborating with you already.
Haven't quite connected with the fashion scene in Italy, but perhaps we should reach out and explore.
We started with a thought experiment. Let's finish with a thought experiment. My partner, she's very, very smart, but she has prosopagnosia. She cannot recognize faces. Mm-hmm. So when she goes up to a person, she has learned not to say, pleased to meet you, because she may have met this person who knows how many times before. Will her clothing be able to tell her who this person is and what their interests may be, perhaps?
It's possible. Just imagine the smart glasses that you can buy today, having some kind of memory about the people you've met and some recording about audio you heard. And so in a not too distant future, you can perhaps envision combining this with AI or machine learning, all these large language models that today we can integrate, for example, in chat and embed them in perhaps your glasses that may suggest you are about to meet person so-and-so. And there is, of course, a question of privacy and concerns that people may not want to be recognized. And that's, again, going back to the question of ethics or, you know, how do we deal with that? How do we grapple with that as a society? But I think the technology is not too far. And so in principle, such a solution could exist.
Yes, she came from Italy and now she's a professor of mechanical engineering and physics at the California Institute of Technology. Press a button and your shambolic clothing will be smooth and pressed and in touch with ABC News. Well, next week we shall welcome back a graduate who first appeared on The Science Show when she was just 15. Now she's at ScienceWorks in Melbourne. Zofia Witkowski-Blake is exploring the wonders of collecting bugs in league with a partner, Clarice Sawyer, entomological entrepreneurs both.
I think the passion started for me when I was a child. I was a massive nerd. I was obsessed with Charles Darwin and his collaborator, Alfred Wallace. Alfred Wallace was a butterfly collector, and I wanted to be like him. So I got into insect collecting because the barrier for entry was so small. Insects are everywhere, even in a highly urban landscape. My mum helped me out a lot with that. I remember trapping a wasp with a picnic basket and putting in my freezer to kill it for my collection, which is pretty macabre for an 11-year-old. But that's how I started. And then I realized selling insect taxidermy would be a more interesting alternative to working at KFC. So that's how I got started with my current job, basically.
You mean selling the insects and taxidermy? In other words, you're preserving them so that they can be kept?
Yes, yeah. So I get my insect specimens from conservation farms overseas, so principally in Indonesia and Peru, and they're all non-endangered species, so they're all non-site specimens, and they're all farmed, so it's a sustainable practice. And then I do the taxidermy in Melbourne, and I sell them to whoever wants them, which is a very diverse crowd, I find.
Clarice Sawyer and Zofia Witkowski-Blake responding to the Prime Minister's entreaty for science and technology as a domestic enterprise, bugs for fun and collecting. And yes, Darwin did it too. That's next week, plus 65,000 years ago, when humans first arrived in Australia. What did they have for dinner? You'll be surprised. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and technical inspiration from Roy Huberman. I'm Robin Williams, and this is CPE Bach.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.